You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, we'll be talking with Christina Enriquez about her latest novel, The Book of Unknown Americans, published by Knopf in June of this year. Christina's previous work includes the award-winning collection of short stories, Come Together, Fall Apart, and her previous novel, The World in Half. So welcome, Christina. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So your book was great. I really loved it. I also love epigraphs, and yours is from Bob Hickok, who's a great poet, and it reads, "Let us all be from somewhere. Let us tell each other everything we can." So what gave rise to you using that as an epigraph, and did it come before the book, after the book, in the middle of the book?
I'm really glad you pointed out. You're the only person who's brought that up so far, and I love that little, those little two lines. I mean, I feel like they were kind of a guiding light for me as I was going through the book. I didn't happen upon them until about midway through the book. It's from a poem I read of his that was in The New Yorker, and it's the last two lines of that poem, and I just felt like I think the poem is, I can't totally remember, but I think it's specifically about like a state. I want to say maybe like Indiana. Or
no, it's Michigan.
Michigan, okay, somewhere in the Midwest, and I so it's like not related necessarily. Although those two lines really resonated with me, and the idea of like people telling their stories and sharing the places that they're from, and you know what they've left behind, where they came to, all that kind of stuff, certainly, you know, made its way into the book. But sometimes when I felt like I was getting a little bit lost in the book, I would think about those lines again. And like I said, they were kind of this guiding light for me.
Yeah, and that gave rise to the idea that each of your protagonists, because there's a bunch of them, could each tell their story at the beginning of the time that they first appear in the book.
Yeah, there's 11 narrators in total, which is a little bit insane. but yeah, everybody gets a chance at some point to tell their story, so you know, that was important to me.
It's always daunting because when you're a reader and you look at a book and you see the chapters are Alma, Mayor, you know, it's like, oh no, how am I going to be able to read this? I'll never keep them straight. But you do, because you know you're following the narrative, and you don't like skip around, so that the narrative follows the characters, each explaining who they are, and then they're involved in the succeeding chapter, so.
Yeah, I mean, and the way, I mean, there's 11 narrators, but which, yeah, as you point out, might sound overwhelming, but there's the real main narrative arc of the story, like all the plot developments happen between two characters, and those are Mayor and Alma. So it's fairly easy, hopefully, to follow along. But I gave the book to my dad, and he, after it was published, and he had the same reaction. He got like three chapters in, and he was like, how can I keep track of all these people? I was like, just stick with it. It'll be fine.
Well, now I don't feel so bad if you said it. But it's funny, you know, again, as a reader, and this is great for when you have book clubs, and, you know, I own an independent bookstore, and I'm sure it'll be a book club selection for us. But while I'm reading the book, I'm thinking to myself, who are the protagonists? And as you said, it's, you know, the one family that come to America because of specific circumstances. But sometimes I thought of Maribel as being kind of like the pivot point of everything.
Yes.
And also in an almost magical way at times.
Yeah, she is the person upon whom everybody's actions sort of hinge. I mean, everybody is motivated in different ways by different feelings toward her and about her, wanting to protect her or wanting to show her certain things or wanting to make her life better or whatever. And interestingly, though, she's the only one in the book who, I guess, doesn't actually have a chapter to herself. She doesn't have space to tell her story, which has been brought up to me by multiple interviewers. And, I mean, I don't know exactly why that ended up being that way. It just felt to me right that she would influence so much of the action without having to have that kind of assertive role.
Well, the thing is, she actually is missing the space that may be her story, you know,
right.
Kind of like that, because she was at one point this vivacious, wonderful, you know, person.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, she doesn't exactly have the words anymore.
Yeah.
Because she suffered this brain injury, and so she can't actually tell. I mean, there's little parts. There's this notebook that she keeps that she walks around with to help herself stay organized, and so we get a few glimpses of that, for example. But yeah, by and large, she's just the sort of middle point for everybody else.
But she's still a lovely person, and outside and inside, I think.
Well, thank you.
You know, what's really funny is we're just outside of Philadelphia here, so.
Yay, Philly.
So my family's in the building business, and somebody offered us the prospect of buying a property in Kennett Square, the mushroom capital of the world,
yeah.
as you know. And we went there and looked at it, and we had two thoughts. One was, we certainly weren't going to buy this so they could close it down and all these people could lose their jobs. And the second point, we didn't want to buy something that was so kind of disgusting. So
yeah.
It was like it juxtaposed the fact that here are these people coming and this is what they're subjected to, you know,
yeah.
The back of their hands being scraped off and working in a kind of mildewy, moldy, mm-hmm. you know, the way mushrooms live isn't the way people are supposed to live.
Right. Yeah. And they make the point of that, I guess, at one point when Arturo first starts that job, he, talks about how he's, you know, working in this like windowless, airless, dark room all day, and Alma's, you know, completely mystified that's what they would have come to. But, you know, he also makes a point to say that he's grateful for it because it's going to give them possibly the chance to make their daughter better.
Yeah, everybody, you know, and I think some of the reviews have talked about it, that everybody seems to end up in this one place in Delaware. And, you know, and one reason is because there's no sales tax, and the Dollar Tree is cheaper than the Latino, the Latin store. But it's really a lousy place to live. Well, you used to live there, so I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, I grew up there, so watch it, man.
Well, I mean, it's like when you go to Baltimore, like the Inner Harbor and all, it's really nice, but then if you step back two streets, it's not,
yeah, no, it's like everywhere. I mean, there are parts of it that are worse than others. You know, but I mean, part of the point for me was that, and I've had this reaction a lot going around talking about the book, is that people typically ask, why Delaware? Why would you set it there? And, you know, part of the reason for me was that I wanted to show that this is a story that happens everywhere. This is not just a story that's in L.A. or Houston or Chicago or, you know, metropolitan areas. This was an American story that happens in every pocket of the country that you could possibly imagine, even a place like Delaware, you know, that there would be these communities of immigrants. And people don't seem to realize that, maybe.
Well, it's funny because, you know, you feel so much for each of these people who dreamed so much and, you know, the hackneyed phrase, the American dream, and they wanted it and they did their very best to get it. And with the exception of perhaps Raphael and Celia, we can talk about that a little later, but no one really gets the American dream that they thought they were going to get when they came over. And I was kind of thinking about the situation in the world today with Syria and Palestine and Iraq and the Ukraine and that horrible plane crash. And I was thinking, nothing that bad is happening here in Delaware in your book, but why does it feel so, I don't know, like the weight of the world is on their shoulders, all of them?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's because it's just a very human story. They just have very human struggles that people can, you know, see themselves in, maybe in an unexpected way. You know, you don't think maybe that you're going to be able to relate to these people or connect with them or these characters. But, you know, that was other part of the story for me, or one of my other goals when writing it was to make them identifiable. You know, which they are, of course. It's not like that much of a stretch, you know? They're just people who want the same things that most of us want, and which is exactly how the book starts and what Alma says in the beginning. We wanted the same things everybody did, you know, to eat good food, to sleep at night, to be well, for our children to be healthy, and that she feels like it's their right as much as it's anybody's to ask for those things and to hope for those things.
There was a segment on Jon Stewart, The Daily Show, and was one of those interviewers that's kind of funny. And he was talking to this Republican talking head about, and the guy was talking about how Obamacare is going to destroy the government and make us right now we're the number one healthcare system in the world, which is obviously not true. We're the 37th. And the guy says, well, what are these people supposed to do? That he goes, well, they have to stop being poor.
Uh-huh.
And he goes,
it's that easy.
Yeah,
if you just decide to stop, then magically, you know, says, everything works out for you.
Yeah, just get your GED. Stop. And the guy says, so they just need to, if they're poor, they just need to stop being poor and that'll do it. And he goes, yeah.
It's an excellent solution.
That's great. That's what the guy said. That's what the interviewer said. What a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the idea of not being able to get out and being in something where you can't get out. And
right, despite all your best efforts, you know, and despite trying to do every single thing that you thought you were supposed to do and that you've been told that you were supposed to do. I mean, the Riveras come from Mexico, and they take great pains to go through the process to get a visa, to be able to come here legally, you know, and things still, despite all of that, don't work out for them in the ways that they hoped that it would. So, yeah, that's the hard thing.
Well, it's like Gustavo. He works so hard, harder than, you know, someone like George Bush could ever consider working in his life. And he works so hard, and what he does with his money is he wants to make sure that his family grows up better than,
yeah,
you know, he wants to hand it off to them and do the best he can for them. And I was thinking, again, because we're in the building business, we use this company, I better not say the name, it's a landscaping company, and it's really not a landscaping company, it's a people management company, because all the laborers are from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so what those laborers do is they'll stay in a place like Extended Stay America, where they get a breakfast, and they stay like 10 to a room, and then almost all the money they make, they just send back home.
Right.
And they're so admirable, you know? It's such a noble way to live. And but no one, there are very few people in America that understand that or give that any respect.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But, oh, and the bad guy is Garrett.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to throttle him the whole time. You know, it's like you made him so horrible.
He is horrible. I mean, there's a little moment. I forget. It's near the beginning of one of the chapters where he's kind of sitting out of gym, like he's just sitting on the bleachers and he's kind of being punished in a way. I mean, I wanted him. I wanted there to be some glimmers of, not like sympathy for him, but of understanding maybe what he's coming from and why he's turned out the way he has. But yeah, he's fairly awful. I mean.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that thing about anger is just fear turned outward.
Yeah.
That's like him.
Yeah.
And it's funny how things work in America, because there's always this doesn't sound right, but there's always this hidden underbelly that we don't like anyone to know about. And it's like no one would ever say we lost the Vietnamese War or the Vietnam War, or that mission accomplished wasn't mission accomplished and they deleted from the photo now. And so
no
this
one in mainstream media anyway, or I mean, it takes like a lot of courage to stand up and say those kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's so funny, because I always am so incredibly idealistic that I'm unrealistic. Like, I know what the Statue of Liberty says in its face, you know, and I always think, well, why would we have immigration reform if someone wants to come here? We're supposed to welcome this. We're supposed,
right.
You know, but then that makes no sense either, does it?
Well, it doesn't make sense in today's climate, and it's interesting. I mean, when people think of the Statue of Liberty and they think of immigrants coming to Ellis Island, at that time, people were just welcomed. You didn't have to have papers. It was totally a different system. So things have just changed, you know, little by little politically. There's been different things that have changed the face of immigration and the landscape of immigration. Such that now it feels very clear to me that we do need reform. I mean, it's not working right now. It's incredibly hard. When I was researching, I did a little bit of research for this book. I try never to do too much, but one of the things I did was I actually read the book, the handbook that someone ostensibly who was trying to get a visa to come here would read to try to figure out what kind of paperwork they have to file and that kind of stuff. And the thing that I learned mostly is how incredibly complicated and difficult it is to come here legally, especially from certain countries, and especially if you are a low-skilled worker. So, yeah. I mean, there's only very, very slim categories of people who, you know, are eligible to even get a visa to be able to come here. And it excludes so many people that I think, you know, there's a lot of people who just make that argument blithely of, like, get in line or, you know, get your papers and then come here. But they don't really realize what exactly that takes or would take for somebody. And I think that's the part of the system, to me, that needs to be reformed, is that you basically need to make it easier for people to be able to come here legally. I mean, people don't want to come without papers and without documentation. But
they have, you know, no choice.
It's very difficult to do it any other way in some circumstances.
I always think about the U.S. citizenship test, too, the exam, and I think, you know, what if you just pulled someone off the street here in Westchester and took them in and asked them those questions?
Right.
They wouldn't know it.
Yeah, that wasn't, and, you know, gaining citizenship by being born in the United States just de facto wasn't always part of citizenship in this country either. That was something that somewhere along the line, you know, changed and became part of the system. So I've been reading a lot about it and thinking a lot about it lately, you know, in relation to this book, but there's so much of it still that's beyond me, but it seems very clear to me, that there needs to be reform.
So speaking of the citizenship, and we can't talk about every character in the book, but if you do talk about Raphael and Celia,
yeah,
and the fact that they did take that test, and that she is able to make sandwiches where she cuts the crust off of the white bread.
Uh-huh.
Have they achieved the American dream? Is that the one family?
I think to them they have. The other person I think of when I think of achieving the American dream, it's not the dream she set out to achieve, but I think Nelia Zafón, who she has come, and she's one of the neighbors who just has a few pages where she tells her story, but she tells about, she wanted to be an actress, and she never really made it on Broadway, but now she owns her own theater company in Delaware and Wilmington. So to me, I feel like she's also somebody who has made it in certain ways. But Celia and Rafael, they came from Panama after Noriega was ousted by the U.S. and a few years after. And their story is somewhat based on my dad, who came here in 1971 to study chemical engineering at the University of Delaware. So he had come from Panama. But I remember, or we have photos, you know, of him taking his citizenship test and or of getting his citizenship. And there was, like, on local TV, you know, like the local broadcast of whatever's happening in, like, the village hall or something. And there was a feed of him standing there at the ceremony. And I remember my mom and I being at home and watching it.
Were you really proud?
I think I didn't really know exactly what was happening. I was young, but I had the sense of how proud my mom was about it, and I think that rubbed off on me. So,
what's the one line that that's quoted in all the reviews, which is basically that America's willing, like when she talks about Rita Moreno, you know, when she wants to be on Broadway, but they already have one.
Oh, yeah. I haven't been reading the reviews, so I don't know.
It's basically America's willing to take one
of everybody.
Yeah,
she's like, we had Rita Moreno, we had Tintin, we had Desi Arnaz. You know, America wants one person from everywhere. But then more of us, you know, they're like, oh no, we were not actually interested in you people. We were just curious. You know.
Yeah, I know, and it's like, you know, that one line where, who says it, you know, like when someone finds out you're Mexican in America, it looks like you came directly from hell.
Yeah, that's Micho.
Yeah.
He has a very strident little monologue there toward the end.
Yeah, he does.
Probably the most political or overtly political moment of the book. But I think, you know, he says some really important things.
Yeah, he's full of himself a little bit, but he should be, you know, he's not going to denigrate himself because of who he is.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is about, you know, we talked about Garrett, but then if you talk about Mayor, you know, he's not a paragon of what a person should be because he lies. And, you know, he lies and he lies, and that gives rise to a lot of things that happen in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, he sets into motion a chain of events that has really dire consequences for a lot of people, and he's doing it because he's a teenager, he's in love with this girl, Maribel, he feels like he would do anything for her, and basically, you know, he throws all kind of like logic and good sense out the window and does. He does what he thinks he should do for her and can do for her. But then, you know, it has these terrible consequences.
Yeah, I just realized, it's funny, the two seminal parts in the book, and they all involve blame, is the incident that brings Maribel to the United States, for which Ama blames herself, kind of rightfully so. And then Mayor, who, because of a car that he takes, also sets into, like you said, this chain of events. And those things have nothing to do with nationality or immigration or anything like that.
No.
They just have to do with, could happen anywhere in any town USA.
Yeah. It could happen to anybody. Yeah, and I wanted to tie those things together. I mean, there was a deliberate parallel of the blame that bubbles to the surface for both of those characters. And Mayor sort of tackles it head on about, you know, could he blame himself or who is to blame? And he traces it back and sort of ends up at this conclusion that, you know, you can't ever figure out who or what is exactly to blame for anything, which is a way of letting himself off the hook in one regard, but in another way is partly true, I think.
What do you think about it yourself and in your life and your experiences?
I mean, I think that the way he susses it out is kind of the way I think about things. Like, I tend to blame myself if something goes wrong that I was involved in, but then upon further thought, I try to give myself the benefit of the doubt and, you know, think around it and all the other things that could have happened. I mean, so this thing with Alma, and she, you know, blames herself for something that happened to Maribel earlier in the book, or actually before the time that the book actually starts, but there's a flashback that tells it. It's weird because, so then like a few months after I wrote that scene, I was here at home, and my son is allergic to dairy, and my husband took a milk box that was already open, because my daughter does drink milk, took a milk box out of the refrigerator, and my son was on the floor crawling around, and some of the milk bubbled up through the straw and landed on him, on his back, on the baby, and through his shirt and everything. I mean, and all it had done was touch him. He didn't ingest it or anything, but his entire back broke out in hives. And, you know, there was this moment of panic, and we gave him Benadryl, and he was fine in the end. But I could see it all over my husband's face, like how much he was blaming himself for this very, very minor thing that was clearly an accident. And it just reinforced to me the emotions of that scene and what somebody, you know, who feels like they were somehow involved in their own child, you know, being hurt or something, like how you would carry that around with you, how inevitable that seemed that you couldn't let that go.
Yeah, I do that with everything. And 20 years of therapy has not helped at all. I really do try. You know, it's like, you know how people can compartmentalize things and they have like these little boxes and they're pretty much opaque so you can just stuff something in there? I can't do that. It all just floats around and then it attaches to something, and it's difficult at best.
I don't know. Maybe I have some weird defense mechanisms built into my psyche where I'm like, okay, it wasn't totally me or... But it takes me a little while to get to that point, you know. You carry the blame for a while, obviously.
Oh, so that's a good question. Like, when you're writing, do you procrastinate at times? Like, I make lists of lists. Do you, like, are you driven to this? I know some of the questions you were asked in that interview for, what is it? You know, what's that? Oxford, the Oxford thing? There was an interview, the Southern Literature Magazine.
Oxford American?
Yeah. You talk in there about why you write, and you know, they ask them, some of the questions are kind of silly actually, but do you feel like you're compelled to do it? Like you said, you see this flat surface, you have your pen, they're very simple tools, and then do you just get up and start writing? Or,
oh my gosh, that's from the way back machine.
Yeah, I know. It was before this book was. Yeah,
you did a lot of research. I don't like to be like hyperbolic, like, oh, I have to do it in order to breathe. I don't think it's like that for me, but I do definitely have the sense that if I don't do it in some kind of regular way, and it doesn't have to be every day, but just in some kind of regular way, that I get very cranky. I get very restless. You know, like right now I haven't started a new project. I've been working on a few stories and I've been doing some essays to promote the book, but I'm so anxious right now that I haven't started something new. And it's not because like there's any market pressure or because anybody's telling me I need to turn something in or do something. It's just my own feeling of like, I want to be sitting down and writing.
I'm glad I found a neurosis in you, because you know.
Otherwise, I seem very normal.
Yeah, well, now I've just been doing this.
If you hung out with me longer, then it would all come peel away. He would see it all.
Well, I was making all these confessions. I really, you were fine. Now at least there's something wrong with you. Do you ever?
Yeah, no, but there's an extreme feeling of, yeah, right now, because I haven't done it for a while. I haven't, you know, I haven't found my direction. I haven't figured out what I'm doing, and I want the time to sit down and work on something else. And I've been getting lots of invitations to go places and, you know.
That's nice.
Yeah, so that's all been great. And I'm extremely grateful for it. And I've been putting the writing on the back burner to be able to do all of these things. But I can feel it kind of bubbling up inside of me that I need to get back to it soon, or, you know, everybody in my path, watch out.
Well, do you think that, like, if when you do get back to it, do you think there'll ever come a time in your life where you say, hey, I think I'll write a science fiction novel or some kind of magical fiction, Gabriel Garcia Marquez kind of novel?
I could see doing something totally different.
You can?
Yeah. I could see just branching out and just, like, throwing a dart at a board and being like, okay, I'm going to try this and just see what happens. Yeah.
My father, whenever he would build a new community, he had a map of Wales on the wall, and he would just throw a dart at the map, and wherever it landed, that would be the name of the new community. But since it was Wales, they were really lousy names, like Tarancoid. One was called Rhonda. I mean, who would name a community Rhonda? Rhonda Fleming? I mean, this, and you know, Cadwallader. I kept telling him, you should have picked a different country.
Oh. So, I was just in Wales for the first time a few months ago.
Was it nice?
And it was funny. Yeah, all the signs and stuff, we were joking. The person I was with, we were joking about all the consonants and, yeah, how weird all the names looked of everything.
Yeah, no one could pronounce any of our towns. I don't know. How do you pronounce Tarancoid? They don't know what to say.
It's good, though. It's, you know, you stand out that way.
Yeah, there isn't any other one. It's true.
Yeah.
Oh, and the other thing that was interesting about you, and I tied it to your book, was in that same review, they ask you, you know, what's one thing you don't like doing at all? And you talk about, which is the same as me, taking this multiple kind of trip. Like, I mean, I hate connecting flights.
I hate it.
I like to go from one place to another. I will not check my bags ever. I went to China for 3 weeks, did not check my bags.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't like planning for it. I just like getting on and getting off.
I'm glad that that's the answer I gave, because as you were saying it, I was thinking to myself, the answer I would give now is multi-leg transportation. So at least I'm consistent. No,
that's true.
I hate if I have to, you know, take a train and then connect to a bus, and then from the bus I have to get on. Ugh, I don't know.
And here's how you...
And I'm also like a very nervous driver, so I hate it if I have to drive.
Oh, well,
like tomorrow night I am going to Boswell Book Company to do a reading with Rebecca Mackay, who
cool.
has this fabulous new book out called 100 Year House. Anyway, I'm making her drive me.
Well, see, look, it all ties to your book, because when Raphael buys the car, he's driving along at 25 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So that's like you right there, nervous driver. And then the other thing is, Arturo also has to take these multiple trips just to get to work.
Uh-huh.
A bus and a bus and a bus.
Uh-huh.
And then, wait, there was something else I was thinking. Shoot. Who else? Oh, Alma. in the beginning when she takes that trip and gets off at the wrong
spot. Oh, that's one of my biggest fears, is getting lost on a bus.
Oh, that was horrible for me because I was thinking, how the heck is she going to get back? It's pouring down rain. You know, that was, yeah, there's some...
I'm perpetually terrified that I'm going to miss the stop and then end up in who knows where and not be able to get back. I don't know
why
that's a thing. I mean, but that's unreasonable because I, you know, there's no way I could go too far and I speak English. Like, for her, it was so much worse.
Oh, God, it would be horrible. Just horrible. She just lucked out getting back, I mean.
Yeah.
But, yes, I'm so weird. Sometimes I'll get off at the wrong spot because I'm not sure whether it's the wrong spot or the right spot. So I get off anyway, kind of subconsciously knowing I'm already getting off at the wrong spot because its name is somewhat similar.
Right.
What about at the airport? Do you get there, like, 3 hours early?
I don't normally. That's one where I'll kind of cruise in and get on the plane. But that's partly because, like you were saying, like, I won't check bags if I don't have to. Unless I'm with the family and with my kids, then we obviously have to check because we have too much stuff. But if I'm traveling by myself, I mean, I just, on tour, I ended up taking a tote bag with clothes in it, you know? I just wore the same pants every day and the same shoes, and I like to travel as light as I can. But
yeah.
The benefit of that is I can cruise into the airport a little bit, you know, not too early, and just hop on the plane usually.
Well, I get there really early, and my ex-wife used to like to get to the plane as the door was closing, which could be part of the reason why we're...
Cause no I would, longer together.
Yeah, because I would yell and scream at her, and she wouldn't want to leave, and I'd say, we got to leave, we have to leave. It's, you know, and when I'd always get there so early, it was horrible. Still do. But how does all this affect you and your family, the fact that you're big shot now?
I mean... That's debatable, I think, and to them, I'm certainly not. So, you know, I mean, my daughter is 7, and she is too cool for school, so she's not super impressed with anything. She came to my reading, I had a reading in Philadelphia, actually, at the Free Library.
Oh, sorry, I missed that one.
Oh, that's okay, and she came to that. My whole family came, because my parents still live in Delaware. So, anyway... They were sitting in the front row, and it was very sweet, and I gave her a little shout-out and everything. And then a few weeks later, we were back here in Chicago, and I had a reading, and some of my friends from town were going to go, and one of them was bringing her kids, who was friends with my daughter. And I said to my daughter, do you want to go to the reading? Your friends are going to be there. She just looked at me, and she said, haven't we already done this? I was like, okay.
That's a great thing to say because it really does help you keep things in perspective.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, they're not letting me get a big head about anything at all.
Well, I work out twice a week. I have this trainer, and the only reason I have the trainer is because otherwise I wouldn't do it. But when I was in good shape, which was a while ago, I thought I looked really cool, so I bought this muscle shirt, you know, sleeveless shirt, and I thought I'd wear that. I'm looking at myself in the mirror thinking, oh, for my age, I look pretty good. So then I look up in the corner of the room. My daughter's standing. She has her arms crossed. And she looks at me and she goes, do you think you look good in that? Which, that was the last. I didn't wear any more.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about kids. They just keep you very grounded. But it is sweet. I mean, my son, who just turned 2, but he, you know, if he sees my book, if I have a copy sitting out or something that I'm trying to do something with, and he sees it on the table, he'll go over to it and grab it and say, Mommy book! Mommy book! That's kind of sweet.
That is nice. It's nice because, like, that's kind of what's happening with my granddaughter and me. That, you know, I was thinking, you know, say I own this independent bookstore. I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if my grandfather owned a bookstore and I could go over and just sit there? And so I think it'll be really nice when she gets older just to come over. They're only like half a mile away. They can just come over and she can just sit in the bookstore and I can read to her and she can just wander around. So I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Yeah, that seems like some kind of fantasy.
Yeah, I
know. I mean, for the kid, I don't know, I would have loved that. And my daughter's a big reader now, so we're always, seems like, in bookstores hanging around and she's checking things out and trying to figure out what next series she's going to get into.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the same thing at our store, too, the series.
Yeah. Right now it's Thea Stilton. She really likes those.
Yes.
I guess who's Geronimo Stilton's sister? I don't know. I just learned about all this, but she has like 3 of them, and she's pretty into those.
Yeah, I can't keep track of them. Isn't it nice, the free library is a really nice place to read. I mean, Philadelphia Library, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah. It was. I can't believe I'd not ever been there before somehow. I mean, I grew up in Delaware, and we would go to Philadelphia all the time because there's not that much to do in Delaware. But somehow I'd never been to the free libraries. Yeah, it was really nice. And I read with Sarah Bird, whose new novel is Above the East China Sea. And so that was really nice to share the stage with her. And yeah, it was good.
It was funny because this is kind of like an immigration story you could never do it today. But when I was 8 and my brother was 6, my mother would let us go downtown on the train by ourselves from where we lived. And we used to go to the library, that same library, every Saturday. We spent all day there. It was like fairyland.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds great. I mean, right now we live about half a block from our town library. So we're over there pretty much almost every day, I'd say. So that's a nice thing.
Yeah,
and the kids feel like comfortable there, and we know all the librarians, and yeah, that's good.
There really isn't anything better than that. But, you know, if we don't watch out, it's all going to go away, and I have to worry about that too.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, because I could talk forever, but anyway, your book was wonderful. It's on the front table of our the cover was really good too. I really liked the cover.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you liked it. That was the second cover that Knopp came up with.
Do they let you vet them, or?
I think I had like veto power, you know, but I didn't have input, or I maybe I did, but I didn't give any input. I don't know. I sort of feel like, you know, they're the publisher, they're in this for a reason, and they're a very, you know, they're a very, very good publisher, so.
Yeah, they are.
There was no reason not to trust them and see what they would come up with. But I think the first cover was a little grittier. It just had a totally different vibe, and there was some book buyers who said maybe it wasn't going to work or didn't reflect the book.
Well, you know,
the bottom line. So then they came up with the second one, which I think is great. And I love the typography on it, with those closed vowels and stuff like that. It's really nice.
Yeah, and it's funny how all those things, fonts, covers. You know, when I first started the store, you know, I kept thinking you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes in the store does, and I do too.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the publishers are smart because they put a bad cover on your book, it honestly won't sell.
I always think it's interesting when books get a new cover for the paperback.
Yeah, I know. We talk about that too.
Yeah. I've never gotten that before. My first two books have both stayed consistent from hardcover to paperback, but I don't know what goes into deciding that a book needs a different cover for a paperback, but I always think it's interesting to see what they come up with the second time around.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, in this cover, it's not like I don't want to say it that way. It's not like negative. It's just the idea that there's, the cover implies that something's missing in this picture, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's the implication. Not the actual expression, just the implication.
Yeah, no, I think the mood of it is just right.
Yeah, I agree too.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, thank you so much for joining us today. It was fun talking to you.
Thank you.
And if you ever get back to Philadelphia, you can come by and sign your book at our bookstore. That'd be great.
Yeah, I'll be back. Actually, I'll be there in October, early October.
Well, maybe I can give
you a I will let you know.
Yeah, I'll give your publicist a call sometime, and we'll see if we can do something.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
So thanks very much for listening to my talk with Christina Enriquez regarding her new book, The Book of Unknown Americans, which was just published in June. As usual, I gave away a lot more psychological information about myself than I probably should have, but you probably heard it all by now anyway. So next week, the Avid Reader welcomes Dave Goldberg to discuss his recently released paperback bestseller, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. So if you ever wanted to learn about the Higgs boson or Schrodinger's cat or Einstein's theory of relativity, join us for that one because you'll have your questions answered. And as always, thanks very much for listening, and we will talk with you next week.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.